Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony will conclude its classic season with a wonderful program of War Horses. Now that's an affectionate name for very familiar music for classical devotees as well as consumers of pop culture. Tchaikovsky's rousing Symphony No. 4 and Aaron Copland's beautiful Appalachian Spring headlined the concert, along with Franz Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2, a feast of Eastern European folk tunes, which a couple of generations were first exposed to through a 1946 Bugs Bunny cartoon. The concert will be led by a frequent guest conductor with the orchestra, Gerhard Zimmermann. For 42 seasons, he has been the music director of the Canton Symphony Orchestra in Ohio. He's also the conductor laureate of the North Carolina Symphony, where he served for 20 years, and a former music director of the Breckenridge Music Festival, again serving over two decades. He'll lead the Tulsa Symphony tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. You can learn more about the concert at tulsasymphony.org. Gerhard Zimmermann returns to Studio Tulsa today. Gerhard Zimmermann, it's always a pleasure to have you back on Studio Tulsa, and welcome back to Tulsa.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
I guess you look forward to seeing the orchestra. I mean, along with your own orchestra in Canton, this is perhaps, at this point, something you're doing every year now.
Yes, I do look forward to coming back. I love working with the orchestra. They're very attentive. They're very anxious to do what I ask them to do, and it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, especially if I give them an idea that I might have, and it's new to them, and it might take two times through, you know, for them to catch on. But it's a wonderful orchestra to conduct.
Can you give me an example of something, a new idea? Is it a way of looking at a particular phrase or a sort of concept for a movement, or what exactly?
I think it really boils down to a concept of sound. Mm. And we worked on that a little bit last night, where you don't have, with all those violins there, you don't have to force the sound individually. In fact, it's going to sound large if they're in tune and if the vibrato matches and they're in the right part of the string or the right part of the bow. When that happens, I tell an orchestra to play chamber music. Mm. You know, there's a 75-member string quartet, something like that, or a 75-member woodwind quintet.
Yeah. In the case of this concert, you have a lot of extremes as far as that sound conception, because Tchaikovsky has certainly a sound profile very different from Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, which is, even though it's written for a full orchestra, it still almost sounds at times like it's written for the 13 players it was originally written for.
Right.
Transparent, so transparent. So I guess that's the challenge of this concert, I would think.
Well, it's also a challenge with, we have the first rehearsal of the Copland tomorrow evening, I believe, our second rehearsal for Tchaikovsky and the Liszt tonight. The Liszt, we talked a lot about not forcing the sound and just letting it sing. I mean, Tchaikovsky was an opera composer as well as a symphonist. A lot of orchestras will really play it hard, and it'll be a kind of a steely sound. I told him the story. I said, if you want to know what I don't like in a sound, just go onto YouTube and search for Boston Symphony with Eric Kleinsdorf. And the trumpets and the trombones, I mean, it just parts your hair.
When you listen to Russian symphonies,
right.
I mean, they're all about that sound.
Yes. In fact, I heard a live performance of Prokofiev 5 in Fort Worth with the Bolshoi Ballet Orchestra, and it was difficult to sit there. I mean, it was so loud at times.
What's interesting in a concert like this with the Liszt, Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, and Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 4. So these are very familiar works, even to people who are not regular concert goers, because this music is in and around us, from Warner Brothers cartoons to countless commercials with Appalachian Spring. And of course, the themes of Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 4 show up an awful lot in our culture. So we're speaking about music that in many ways doesn't need an introduction. So what do we need to know about these three pieces?
Well, in that case, I think I'll just leave. No, I'm just kidding. It still takes, you know, marketing and pushing the fact that there is a great orchestra here. mm-hmm. just because of the type of lifestyle Americans live today. I mean, I don't know if we talked about this in years past, but 35 years ago, something like that, both Time and Newsweek magazine came out and said, oh, people will have all this free time. There will be four-day work weeks and everything. And at that time, the man was working and the woman was usually in the home. It certainly isn't that way now, and I don't know where the time is going because they both have to work, and they have all of these activities that their kids go to, and it's difficult. It's difficult.
Yeah, but at the same time, when you do make time for it,
yes,
it can be so rewarding.
There's nothing like it, being a live performance. When I've asked board members in Canton, come to a rehearsal, but let me know you're there. They just don't come in quietly, and I'll seat you up on the stage because that's where it happens.
Yeah.
It's a whole different experience. There on stage, I mean, you live it and you breathe it.
Give our listeners a sense of the difference between what they experience in the hall and what they would experience on stage.
On stage, the sound, you're sort of in the middle of the sound, and you're just... enveloped by it. Mm-hmm. You feel it inwardly. It's a visceral experience. You know, I remember when I auditioned for North Carolina, the principal bass was a bass student at Bowling Green State University, where I went to school. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, you're the only bass player that I've heard that I also feel. He had this huge bass, played with German bow. And of course, German bows, you can really put out a spiccato, like in Schumann and Beethoven. It was just, in Schumann, it sounded like a machine gun. In a good way now, okay? In a good way. But that bass section was phenomenal. Mm. We only had six, but they played. And the sound they supported the overall sound of the orchestra, and it's wonderful.
Well, you know, as from having sat on stages many times, one of the wonderful experiences is feeling the timbre of a certain section, you know, the sort of sound blend and being a part of it. And, you know, it's very interesting. Often when you're on stage, you hear a different blend than you do in the hall. You know, the hall does sort of cover up a few things.
Yes, especially sometimes. If it's a live hall.
Yeah.
Live halls are good halls.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah. Why don't we talk about the music?
Why not?
So this is Franz Liszt, Hungarian Rhapsody number 2.
Yes.
If you grew up of a certain age, you knew this music from a very
Bugs
young
Bunny.
Age. Yeah, that's right.
Bugs Bunny. Yep, absolutely.
But it is this lovely early work of what would become a major part of the 19th century, which is the collection of folk music and mm-hmm. utilizing folk music to tell a larger story. What is the story of the Hungarian Rhapsody number 2 in your view?
In my view,
yeah.
Well, I go more to the personality of it. To me, it's very Hungarian. It's also very Czech. My wife is half Czech.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain personality about that, those two cultures. It's like if you go to a play of Romeo and Juliet, okay? And one is saying, I love you, to the other. They don't say it like, I love you. It's more like, I love you. You know, I mean, it encompasses the whole universe when they say it. And they yell a lot and they scream a lot in their theater. Yeah. And their music is similar. I mean, it is hot-blooded.
Music of extremes.
Yes.
Extreme passion in the more slower segments. And then as frenetic as you can be in its fast sections. And this piece points that out.
Yes, and there's no truer example of that than Liszt's Faust Symphony.
Yeah.
You know, the second movement, Gretchen, and the last movement, Mephistopheles and everything. It's, I think Liszt is very much underrated as a composer. I've done several of the tone poems, and I've always enjoyed them.
I would imagine this piece is fun to conduct as well.
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's because it does wear its passion on its sleeve.
And you do have to be a bit schizophrenic to do it because of all of the quick tempo changes.
No, it's really cartoon music written before there were cartoons. Why don't we hear a little bit of the final chartist of the piece, which it just winds up and winds up and winds up.
Yes.
Here's music from Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra in their season finale concert with my guest today, Gerhard Zimmermann. Here's music by Liszt. That's music by Franz Liszt from the Hungarian Rhapsody No. 2, which will be performed by my guest, Gerhard Zimmermann, with the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra this Saturday evening at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Well, from that music of passion on your sleeve to, you know, rapid changes, rapid fire changes, you go to the Aaron Copland Appalachian Spring, which also has its quick tempo changes, but it's of an entirely different character.
Yes, Aaron Copland... I worked with him once. I conducted his Lincoln portrait with the National Symphony on the lawn of the White House, and he narrated it.
Interesting.
And in the preface to the score, he writes that the narration needs to be read in such a way that there's no inflection. And that's exactly the way he read it. There's no inflection whatsoever.
And narrators have been ignoring his advice
ever since. That's right. And you know, his music is Aaron Copland. That sounds silly to say that, but I mean, he could write no other music than that. There's a naivety about it. There's an innocence. There's a childlike likeness of it. It's just gorgeous. At the end, where you have the ti-ya-di-da-dum, it's otherworldly.
Yeah.
So it's from a different planet.
It's really interesting because this was originally dance music, and yet when you see recordings of Appalachian Spring, there's wide variations in how conductors do this. And it's really interesting, in the times I've performed it, the interpretation can really vary a bit in like how fast you take the fasts. Sometimes it's breakneck speed. Other times in these beautiful, transparent, slow passages, it's almost... time stops at times. Yeah. How do you approach that particular part of this piece? Because there are so many parts of Appalachian Spring that, as a musician, you want to love. You know, just
absolutely. Yes.
And probably a conductor the same. But you also have to say, okay, we're not doing this for dance, but we got to keep it moving. and you just said thank you.
Now don't tell stories on me. No, I take many more liberties with the score than I would with a dance. Of course, there have been times I remember doing a Nutcracker, and having the coda with the prince, and I finally told him in rehearsal in front of the orchestra, and I said, "Sir, I will change tempos three times. This is in a minute and a half piece."
Right.
I said, "But not six." So you'll get three, and otherwise you'll just have to wait for me, when you finish earlier than I do.
Well,
the worst thing that ever was invented was the record player, the LP player, where you could speed it up and slow it down without changing the pitch.
Yeah.
Because, I mean...
No, I know.
Ballet companies loved that.
Yeah, I know. But let's get back to your performance of Appalachian Spring. You said you really like to take liberties with it. You know, that idea of really loving it. And there's so many moments in this piece where you can you know, you just glory in the sound and the transparency of the sound,
yes.
which is, that's just, they're just wonderful moments.
Yeah, the ending is, I think, some of the finest music ever, ever written. Yeah. It's just surreal. I don't really conduct it. I don't know what I do. I let them play. I revel in their playing. In fact, those are the best times, I feel, the best times when I'm conducting is when I'm not. When the orchestra takes over and they play as a large chamber ensemble. Mm-hmm. That's when it's wonderful.
I was going to say another moment is right before you hear the famous Shakers tune.
Yes.
That little section right before it is, you know, sometimes I've played the piece where let's spend more time with this. It's just so beautiful.
Yeah, right, right.
You know, we can get to the Shaker tune soon enough.
That's right. Yes.
Simple that'll... gifts. You know, it's wonderful. Why don't we hear that little section of
okay.
Aaron Copland?
Great.
This will be one of the pieces the Tulsa Symphony will perform in their finale concert of the season with my guest, Gerhard Zimmerman. Here's music from Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. Music from Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring. My guest is Gerhard Zimmerman, the guest conductor for the Tulsa Symphony's performance this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Chapman Music Hall, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. The Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 4, as we were talking earlier, you know, you're looking for a specific sound, and there are many different sounds that orchestras get when they're playing Tchaikovsky. Some go for the big, over-brassy, almost shrill sound. Russian orchestras tend to do that. You look for a different sound. What is the sound you're looking for?
Well, I've never been a big fan of the brassy sound. I mean, that could part your hair or, you know, knock out a tooth here and there.
Yeah.
Certainly Tchaikovsky is big, and there are places when I like kind of rup-bum-bum-bum-bum-bum from the bass trombone.
Yeah,
and I like a little sass to that, mm-hmm. You know. I don't want it to sound like Wagner, because it shouldn't. But the sound of the strings, and I like to hear much more portamento or sliding in the strings than most people do. For some reason, in the conservatories in this country, I don't know what it's like in Europe because I've spent all my life here. It's not taught to do these slides, and it takes a special way to do them.
Is that a generational thing? Because, you know, when you listen to recordings from the 40s.
Ormandy and Stokowski,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you hear more of that.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But, I mean, listen, we know for sure, okay, through an old recording of a violinist that Brahms worked with to musicological papers with notes from composers and performers, that, number one, especially in Brahms, he expected the tempi to vary. It's not like you have a beginning of the Second Symphony and it stays like that until the next the verbal tempo indication is.
Mm-hmm.
And you also know that he expected the tradition of the portamenti to be done.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a little different than what Mahler expected. Mahler was a little over the top in that way. but I mean, I love it when the strings can do just a great portamento.
Mm.
It's just wonderful.
Yeah, and that's sort of a sliding into the note.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Well, yeah. You can do it one of two ways. You can mm-hmm. either slide from the note
or
down to the other note, or you can not slide from the top note, but start a little higher on the bottom note and then come down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess there are many moments in this Symphony No. 4 where there are those opportunities.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Cello and the violins.
Yeah.
And violas, as far as that goes.
Well, even though, you know, you can't get away from the brass in this piece, it opens the little fate statement that opens the symphony, which, again, appears in the fourth movement. But I always, there's some really interesting parts of this symphony that I've just always found so interesting. And one is the first movement. We know, you know, it's not as memorable a movement as, say, some of the other movements, 3 and 4, for example. And it always seems like the music, and it's, again, his playing against the bar line, where the music seems at odds with itself.
Oh, yes. The place where the orchestra is going against each other in a canon.
Yeah.
Yum, da-dum, 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 bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum. And the other part of the orchestra is off by an eighth note.
Yes.
That's just wonderful. But as far, you know, my favorite part of this symphony, well, one of many, is the tum tum ta di ori ori, and then it just goes to nothing. It's really not too much music that's more beautiful than that.
Yeah, I think that the second movement is again one of those remarkable movements. You know, the beautiful, poignant oboe solo at the beginning, and just this tender-hearted nature, just so tender-hearted.
And then this Russian folk dance, dee-ya-dum-bum-bum-ba-dum-bum-bum, which I do it on the short side. That's the second theme. Mm-hmm. A lot of orchestras, conductors, they, you know, dee-ya-da-da-dee-ya-da-da-da. But when I conduct Mozart, I'll find myself telling an orchestra, change your face. In other words, change your personality from one part of the theme to the next part of the theme. Because it's not like Haydn. Haydn was more or less the same within a given phrase, okay, the same personality. Mozart, for example, the 40th symphony, I like to do it on the long side and then come back with a little lift. To me, that's the magic of Mozart. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's also the magic of Mozart is to wait. The silences are as important, if not more important, than the sounds. Mm-hmm. You know, in the beginning of the Tchaikovsky Last Movement, I'm sure people criticize me for it. I just don't listen to it. I don't go out and hunt it down, you know. But you know how it starts, dum dum dum, pum pum. Then I wait. Dee, dum, bum, ba-ga-da-ga-da-ga-da. And the reason I do that is because in the end, Tchaikovsky writes a bridge.
Oh.
Where it is in tempo.
Yes.
Okay? So the older I get, I hope, the freer I become in my music making, which makes it a little bit more difficult for the orchestra. You know, because... There were several times.
Who knows what old Gerhardt's going to do tonight?
Oh, that's right. There were several times I surprised them last night.
Uh-huh.
But that's the type of music making I love to do. I love the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra when Normandy was there, and Stokowski with his magic with the strings and everything.
Now, well, we're looking forward to a great performance this Saturday night. Three great works to be heard. Many, many times. The Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 4, the Copland Appalachian Spring, and Liszt's Hungarian Rhapsody. Of course, we're also looking forward to seeing you again next season. You'll be back with Bela Fleck and the Juno Concerto.
I did the world premiere with him on that.
Did you really?
Yes, that's his second concerto. The world premiere with the Canton Symphony several years ago.
What do we need to know about that piece? I mean, it sounds like, you know, what is it like to go through a world premiere performance with the composer and the composer as soloist?
Well, the first time that I worked with him, everyone has this, supposedly their prejudice. And I didn't know what it was going to be like to work with a banjo player. Let me tell you something. Bela Fleck hears. He knows what's going on. not only when he's playing, but when he's playing and the orchestra is going at the same time. He knows what's happening. There are some composers that do not hear what you know what I mean? Where they can't really tell if there are wrong notes, or they can't tell if it's a style that they would rather have changed or something like that. But Bela Fleck is wonderful with that.
I wonder if that comes from this bluegrass background, because you're playing in a small group, you're listening intimately with
right.
them, and it's all acoustic, you know, nothing other than just string instruments going at it.
Could very well be.
Yeah. Well, he's a tremendous musician. He can play.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he can make Bach sound.
And he's a wonderful guy. Yeah. He's down to earth, easy to talk to. I mean, yeah. It's great. This will be my third time working with him, I believe.
Yeah. Well, we'll look forward to that appearance. But in the meantime, some great war horses. I guess that's the
war horses. That's what I say. It's probably, you know, that's kind of a.
That's a dated term.
Yeah, Midwestern country, Ohio term, you know. But it matches what I feel like they are. I mean, the Rossini's overtures and pieces like 1812,
yeah.
They're war horses.
Yeah, well, you'll be able to hear them at the Performing Arts Center Saturday night. Gerhard, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Anytime.
Gerhard Zimmerman is the music director of the Canton Symphony Orchestra and a regular guest conductor with the Tulsa Symphony. He'll lead the orchestra in its season finale concert featuring the music of Franz Liszt, Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, and the Tchaikovsky Symphony No. 4. We're going to leave you with music from the third movement of the symphony, as Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
Theater North presents the Nacarima Society requests the honor of your presence at a celebration of their first 100 years, a play by Pearl Cleage. To be staged in the Liddy Dungis Theater of the Tulsa PAC May 21st through the 29th. It's a romantic comedy set in 1964 Alabama in which Martin Luther King is coming to spearhead a voter registration effort in Montgomery, but one powerful matriarch of a local black family has other plans. More information at tulsapac.com.